It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Badger Care Plus recipients will be re-evaluated for eligibility and asked to reapply to the healthcare program for the first time since March of 2020. We'll get the details and find out who is affected. First, millions of Americans donate or sell their blood plasma, often as a way to make a little extra money on the side. What started as a relatively small industry a few decades ago has grown into a $24 billion global operation with over 1,000 plasma centers across the country, at least a few dozen of them here in Wisconsin by a quick count on Google Maps. The U.S. is one of only five countries in the world that allows people to be paid for their blood plasma. In her new book, our next guest shares her own experience on the receiving end of that plasma, and she looks at the problems she sees in the industry, from a disastrous story in China to what she says is a system of exploitation here in the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you donated plasma for money? What was that experience like? How did it fit into your financial situation? Do you work in one of these many centers around the state? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathleen McLaughlin is a journalist and author of the new book, Blood Money, The Story of Life, Death, and Profit Inside America's Blood Industry. Kathleen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, it's nice to be here. Thank you very much.
You're a journalist, Kathleen, so you're interested in this story, but you have a very personal interest as well. Can you talk a little bit about your own experience with what comes out of this industry?
Yeah, of course. It's been an interesting little journey for me because, like you said, I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for more than two decades. So I'm just used to reporting and telling other people's story. But this one is very personal for me. So about 20 years ago, I was diagnosed with a rare autoimmune disease. And the treatment for that illness is periodic infusions of a drug that is made from other people's blood plasma. And over the years, I have spent a lot of time sitting in an infusion chair, to be honest, being really bored. So these drips take about 6 hours and they're quite dull. It's quite dull to be stuck in a chair for 6 hours. And I knew that this drug was made from the plasma parts of many different people. And so I just had this kind of ongoing fascination with who are all these people. I've known people off and on over the years, acquaintances, relatives of friends who have sold plasma, but I've never known that many people. And I knew that there were a lot of people engaged in this practice. I really set out to try and figure out who these people are, why people do it, and how important this has become to people's personal economics. And it's been a really interesting undertaking trying to figure it all out.
We're going to spend most of our time, Kathleen, here in the United States, but I want to start with a kind of a worst case scenario for what was called a plasma economy. You were interested in this because you had reported in China and there were boom towns of plasma there. Can you tell us a little bit about the disaster?
Sure. So I lived in China as a foreign correspondent for 15 years. And I moved there in the early 2000s, which was about a decade after the catastrophe of the plasma economy. So what happened back in the 1990s, China was really trying to figure out all sorts of different endeavors to increase their economy. So every province would come up with different ways that people could make money, you know, that workers could get involved in the system, that profits would grow. It was really turning from a state-owned economy into a capitalist economy. And in one of the poorer provinces called Henan, which is central China, the big idea was what you said, the plasma economy. And that was structuring an entire medical industry around the blood of poor people. So the idea was that farmers in Henan province who had no money, really, I mean, they worked the land and didn't have much beyond that, could get paid for their plasma. And the plasma would get made into life-saving medications like the one that I take, and it could be exported around the world, which seems, kind of a bizarre idea, but this is what they did. Unfortunately, this was during the period that HIV and AIDS were still quite dangerous and deadly, and HIV got into the domestic plasma extraction system in China, and it was spread through plasma centers and the use of unclean systems. So they were reusing needles, reusing tubing, things like that. And it spread the virus like wildfire. There were tens of thousands of people infected with HIV through plasma donation in the plasma economy in China in the 90s. There's never actually been a proper accounting by the government of how many people were made sick and how many people died. Instead, what happened is the Chinese government pretty thoroughly covered up the details of it and kind of tried to make it disappear from history. Two of the women who were the whistleblowers who uncovered this problem had actually fled to the United States and were living in exile here. And over the years, I got to know both of them pretty well. And one, whose name was Wang Xuping, specifically really encouraged me to look at what was happening in the United States with blood plasma. So I've been kind of explaining to people, I thought it was very dystopian and sci-fi that China had this idea for something called a plasma economy. But the fact is, we created it in the United States. It just hasn't gotten that much attention.
Talking to Kathleen McLaughlin about her new book, Blood Money, The Story of Life, Death, and Profit Inside America's Blood Industry. Kathleen, one bit of good news, that that disaster in China, it seems like we're much healthier about the system there. The fear isn't so much spreading disease in this system. But that idea of a plasma economy built around poor people, that you see being replicated here in the United States.
That's right. So yeah, just to be clear, there is very little risk to donors in terms of contracting a virus, and especially not HIV. So plasma and blood science have evolved since this all happened in China. And we now know that treating plasma with heat and doing other things while the medication is being made pretty much eliminates the risk of viral transmission of things like HIV. So what happened in China is the odds of it happening here are slim to none. And that's just because medical science has gotten better. But what we have done is the same thing that China did, which is build an industry based on the body parts of poor people. So most of the rest of the world bans the practice of paying people for their blood plasma because it can be seen as coercive. So it's not a purely voluntary donation if you're paying someone for it. There is an element of coercion to it. And ethicists and global health experts around the world have said, you know, this isn't the way that you want to base a system of blood or plasma donation because there's this element of coercion. But we have let this happen in the United States, and we have really let it grow into a massive economy where there is this aspect of coercion. And people who need a little extra money to get by are doing this primarily for financial reasons. So I think there are a lot of ethical questions around it. There are also some health questions around it that I don't believe have been studied appropriately. So I do think that the potential impacts on a person's health long-term do need to be better studied. But yeah, for me, the main question is, how do we become this society where people sell their blood to buy groceries? And are we really comfortable being that kind of society?
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Mineral Point. Jeremy, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me. I just wanted to share, as a former college student, I lived in Southwest Wisconsin, and I was drawn to donating plasma out of a need to kind of supplement my income as a college student. And so, you know, I was a student who came from a low to no income background. And so I did not slow down and ask questions about plasma and where was it going and what would be the pathway to it helping or being some help to someone. It was mainly a financial necessity to supplement for rising cost of college, as well as, you know, just kind of making up for where I fell short in comparison to some of my classmates.
And Jeremy, can I ask, how often did you donate? People do it maybe once. You can legally do it, I think, up to twice a week.
Yeah. No, I did it, I want to say, maybe once or twice a month. But I will say I was inspired to do it quite more. There's a sort of predatory promotion in Southwest Wisconsin, particularly near the Dubuque, Iowa area. Like, you get incentives to go, you get coupons, you get all sorts of outreach and contact, especially when you enroll. And it's a thing that I see many of my peers get addicted to. But again, it's out of a necessity of shortcoming.
Jeremy, thanks for that call. Kathleen, Jeremy echoing so many of the stories you share in your book.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. I really appreciate it. You know, it is so interesting because college students really are a prime target for this industry. So you will see plasma centers kind of congregate in cities and towns that have big universities and big populations of students like Jeremy who need extra money to get through college. We have made the cost of education so expensive in this country, and we haven't done much to help people with it other than piling on mass amounts of student debt. So in my book, one of the places where I spent a lot of time is a city called Rexburg, Idaho, which has a large university with a lot of kids who are not wealthy. And this is one of the most popular ways for them to, you know, get extra money to buy groceries and books and pay rent and things like that. It's really, really common for college students to engage in this. And I've heard, you know, some people who are sort of dismissive about the concerns of what this does to people kind of write it off as saying, oh, it's just college students. But to me, I actually think that it's pretty important to think about what we're asking of a 19-year-old to sell a part of their body, if that's really something that we should be doing.
Jeremy, thanks for that call. Kathleen, Jeremy also mentions that pay incentive structure and the coupons. This is, he said it was in southwestern Wisconsin. This is a very common part of the industry. Can you talk about how that works?
Yeah, totally. So the way the industry works and the way the system is designed is to get people to come back as often as possible. And so you'll get paid more for the second donation in a week. You'll get month-end bonuses. You'll get coupons. You'll get a bonus if you refer a friend to donate plasma. So the entire payment structure, even though it is framed as a token of appreciation for your time, not an actual payment per se. So they're very careful with the language because the industry does not want this to be regulated as an act of labor. So they're careful with the language, but it is entirely structured around incentives to keep you coming back and donating as often as possible. So if you go the maximum number of times, you can actually sell plasma 104 times a year, which is really an incredible amount. And there are people who are able to do this physically, and they get the most financial rewards from it.
We're talking to journalist Kathleen McLaughlin about her new book, Blood Money, the story of life, death, and profit inside America's blood industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this works? Have you sold plasma yourself now or at some point in your life? How did that fit into your personal economy? Do you use one of these medications that comes out of this industry? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about selling blood plasma with Kathleen McLaughlin. She's a journalist and the author of the new book, Blood Money, the story of life, death, and profit inside America's blood industry. You can join in maybe with your own experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Before we go back to our callers, Kathleen, we heard from one of the demographics you write are targeted by the blood plasma industry for donations, college students. Also, working poor in often in Rust Belt communities, so-called, often here in the Midwest. Can you talk about that other target market?
Yeah, definitely. So I spent a lot of time in Flint, Michigan, which is representative of the demographic you just mentioned. So a lot of people in, I would say, what used to be good working class jobs in working class communities no longer earn quite enough money to have as good a life as they maybe would have 30 years ago. So a lot of the people I met are working in industries and professions full time that should be enough to get by, but they're not quite enough. And so they will sell plasma to supplement a full time job. I spent time with a local news reporter in Michigan who does this, and several other local news reporters as well. It's actually become pretty common for people to do this to not only buy necessities, but also to have a little bit of fun. So I've met people who sell plasma to save up to pay for a vacation that they might not otherwise be able to take. So it's these little kind of, I guess, the good parts of middle class life that we used to be able to get by working one job, you know, where you could raise a family. That's just become so difficult in the United States now, as incomes have not kept pace with the cost of living, and especially in this era of inflation that we're in right now. So it's very common. Plasma centers are very common in the Rust Belt, in the Midwest, in the South, in places where there is more economic hardship, and I would say larger populations. So you might have a small town somewhere that's poor, but you won't find a plasma center there. What the more popular place would be is a city with a larger population, but a larger percentage of that population who is living on the financial margins. So one of the things that surprised me going into this reporting, I really thought it was going to be only the poorest of the poor needed to do this. But it has become something attached to middle class life and what we used to think of as middle class income. So you have poor people, you have working poor doing it, but you have a lot of people who are on paper considered middle class and okay, and they still need this to supplement the salaries that they're making.
Talking to Kathleen McLaughlin about her new book on the blood plasma industry. It's called Blood Money. Back to your calls now with Austin in La Crosse. Austin, hi, what did you want to bring up?
Hi there. Actually just driving by one of these facilities. I have a question regarding if we have concerns about the ethics of such a market as it's built right now, what does the alternative look like? And I guess I'm also just curious if the journalist here has any information about the difference between like blood banks and plasma centers, if I've donated plasma at a blood bank before, and if there's a difference between where my plasma would go from one place and the other.
Interesting questions, Austin. Thanks for the call, Kathleen.
Thanks, Austin. So first, to your first question, I don't think there is any chance this industry is going away. The United States has kind of quietly made a decision that we will allow people to be paid for plasma, and I don't think that's going anywhere. My kind of idea about this after doing all of this reporting is I think people should be paid more. I think the system should be transparent. I think Jeremy mentioned before this thing about, you know, incentives and coupons and things like that. Why don't we have a system that pays people a guaranteed amount every time? And beyond that, I think we are asking a lot by trying to get people to donate plasma twice a week. It's a huge commitment of time. It's a huge commitment of health. And your second question about blood banks, yes, you can donate plasma at places like the Red Cross. Those mainly go into, so there is purely altruistic nonprofit plasma donation, just like blood donation. Those donations of plasma would be more inclined to go into a hospital setting where the medication is made. The plasma industry tends to own the for-profit plasma industry tends to own its own collection centers. So for example, the medication I take is made by a company that owns hundreds of plasma centers across the US. So they own the product from beginning to end, if that makes sense. If you're donating at a place like the Red Cross, it's more apt to end up in the same place that blood would end up, which is nonprofit industry. So in a hospital setting or a medication that is made into those kinds of products. The other piece of that is more plasma is collected through the for-profit companies than through the nonprofit. So if you donate plasma at the Red Cross, you're limited to doing that to 13 times a year. If you donate plasma at a for-profit center, you can do it 104 times a year. So you can kind of just see from those rules that there's a lot more plasma coming in through the for-profit system than there is the nonprofit.
Thanks for that call. John joins us now in Appleton. John, hello.
Yes, hi. I used to donate plasma back in the 90s. I did it twice a week. And I often thought, I was underpaid for my time, because as they say, you're not there selling a product or whatever. You're donating your time. And the thing that irritated me was a small person of 120 pounds would donate 660 milliliters of plasma, where me, I'm a big man, and I would donate 880 milliliters of plasma, and I was paid the same amount as that other person, which would take about 45 minutes for them and closer to an hour for me.
Interesting, John. Thanks for sharing that experience. He was maxing it out there, Kathleen.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I think he's exactly right. It's just, if we're going to do this, and I don't see a way that you can roll it back, you can't, you know, there's millions of people who sell plasma every year. You can't ban it overnight. If we're going to do this, I do think we just need to be more transparent and fair about what we pay people. I mean, a lot of the people I've interviewed have told me, yeah, it only takes, the actual donation process only takes 45 minutes to an hour, but it eats up a half a day where they can't work. And a lot of people get tired afterwards. And so they need to go home and go to sleep. You know, there's a lot involved in this. And so to expect people to do it twice a week for a fuzzy payment system is not fair, I don't think.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Kathleen, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
That's Kathleen McLaughlin, journalist and author of the new book, Blood Money, The Story of Life, Death, and Profit Inside America's Blood Industry. Thanks for your great call. So many people we didn't have time to get to, but you can share your story if you'd like over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We have a conversation set up over there. Coming up after the news, for the first time since March of 2020, BadgerCare Plus recipients will be required to be reevaluated for coverage and re-enroll in the program. We'll explain the changes, get enrollees ready, look at the timeline. You don't need to panic, our guest says, but you should pay attention to what's going on. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps is a familiar American ideal, but can too much self-reliance be a bad thing? We'll talk to an author who says it's gone too far and that we need to do a better job of accepting help from others. Now, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services says we started this year with more than 1.6 million Wisconsinites enrolled in BadgerCare Plus or other Medicaid programs. Congress passed a law that prevented states from dropping people from their Medicaid rolls in March of 2020 because of the pandemic. Starting in April, BadgerCare Plus recipients will once again be reevaluated and asked to reapply for health care coverage. But renewal dates for recipients are going to be different for everybody and spread out over the next year or so. Our next guest says there's no reason for BadgerCare Plus recipients to panic, but they should be prepared. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a BadgerCare Plus recipient yourself? What questions do you have about the re-enrollment process and about health coverage availability here in Wisconsin? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Bobby Peterson is the executive director and public interest attorney for Advocacy and Benefits Counseling for Health, also known as ABC for Health. Bobby, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Let's first of all make sure we know what we're talking about here. What is BadgerCare Plus and who relies on it?
Well, it's a healthcare coverage program that provides important medical care and services for over a million people in Wisconsin. There's other variations of Medicaid that are going to be impacted as well. So other folks out there might be impacted with that have Medicaid coverage or BadgerCare Plus. So it's a pretty big change, and it's important. I think it's important to maintain continuity of healthcare coverage. And there's opportunities to make transitions to other coverage and services. So it's a opportunity to review your coverage and to get updated and hopefully maintain the services that you need.
Now, if somebody out there is on BadgerCare Plus and hearing the news, maybe right now for the first time, what should they be doing right now?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, keep an eye on your mail. If you have an account through access.wisconsin.gov, that's a platform where you can log in and see what your it's an opportunity to look at your benefits and coverage. There's information about what your renewal date is going to be. You'll also be getting that in the mail, so making sure your mailing address is up to date. Contact your local consortium that is coordinating the services and your application. Make sure your mail address is up to date. People have moved a lot over the last couple of years, so keep that up to date. That's one of the most important things to do. And as you said, too, this is going to happen over the course of a year. So not everyone is going to be changing. There's nobody should lose coverage on April 1st. And that's just the date that the process begins. The term that the state has used and across the country, people call it the unwinding. Little weird, but it's meant to convey the sense that this isn't going to happen all at once. It's going to happen over the course of a year. People are going to have an opportunity to get their new information to the county and also possibly transition to other coverage programs.
We are talking to Bobby Peterson from ABC for Health about a change for BadgerCare Plus. After a few year hiatus, people will need to reapply over the course of the next year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bobby, for people who might be eligible for BadgerCare Plus but aren't on it, what do they need to know? What should they be looking at to see if they might be eligible for coverage?
Well, it's an important coverage program for a lot of folks. Kids are the easiest for us to get coverage for. So if you have kids out there that are uninsured, BadgerCare Plus is a great program that might be able to provide some help. Pregnant women, there's expanded eligibility. We want to make sure that all pregnant women get good access to health care and coverage. And then also for single childless adults that are low income, it's an opportunity for healthcare coverage as well. So it's really an important program that allows you to get in to see a doctor, get some important work done, evaluating how you're doing both your physical and mental health, get the services that you need. You also might find that you're eligible for marketplace coverage. That's the healthcare marketplace, or Obamacare, as some people call it, but it's there's opportunities there as well. So if you're not eligible for BadgerCare Plus, you may be eligible for a marketplace plan. If your BadgerCare Plus is ending or there's other activity that might result in a special enrollment period.
What goes into the process of applying or reapplying for BadgerCare Plus?
Well, it's a fairly, decent application that you need to complete, but you're going to need to make sure you have your contact information, income information about your family and family size, household size, so that that's the information that will be collected by the county consortium. You'll be evaluated for eligibility, and the determination will be made. But sometimes mistakes are made in the process, and people have an opportunity to appeal denials, get some help. I think one of the things that we want to really convey to folks out there is that maybe this isn't affecting you yourself, but you may have a family member, a family friend, a neighbor might need a little extra help during this transition. We don't want people to panic about it because it's going to take over the course of a year, but about, 55 to 65,000 people each month will be subject to renewal beginning at the end of May. So it's a lot of folks, and the whole system out there is a little rusty right now. So the people haven't done renewals in a long time, and even the workforce they haven't done a lot of renewals. So everyone's going to have to get back to where they were 3 years ago. because this process hasn't, it's been suspended really for 3 years during the public health emergency. And there were good reasons that we did that. I mean, we don't want people during the pandemic to not have health care coverage. So the federal government gave Wisconsin extra funding to say, just keep people enrolled because it's too important that they maintain coverage right now. So, but that's 3 years is a long time, and now the process is ending, and people have to go through some new, jump through a few hoops to maintain their coverage.
I want to talk some about outreach on this. As you mentioned, one of the ways people would be notified is by mail. People move, they have moved over the last 2 years. This might be low-income people who may have housing insecurity. They may have moved a lot. Are there going to be efforts to reach out to them apart from, you know, a mail that might go to two addresses ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're going to be, they're working with, you know, some healthcare providers or working with a lot of folks out there really to hopefully track down people and make sure they know what's going on. And this is why, as I said, it's important for all of us to be thinking about those folks that we know that might need a little extra help, people that maybe in transition, maybe have moved a couple times, maybe off the grid a little bit. And so reaching out to help those folks, doing some outreach. There's been a lot of work done across the state. We have regional enrollment networks that were set up that are actively working and doing outreach and education, trying to make sure that we find all the folks over the course of this next year to keep them covered, because there's the possibility in this change that people will just lose coverage. And even people that lose coverage initially may be able to get reconnected. We may be able to, it might be a paperwork snafu, could be just, you know, things that we can fix. So even don't assume you're going to be denied. Go through the process, get some help. And if you are denied, it may be worth just trying to review it and work with an advocate to try and review it and get some help to see if you really are still eligible. Or you can transition to a marketplace plan, which could be really quite affordable as well.
And you mentioned getting some help for people out there who, for one reason or another, might have difficulty going through this application process. On a practical level, who should they reach out to? Who can they reach out to for help?
Well, we're recommending people go to the wiscovered.com website. It's a partnership between the state of Wisconsin, Covering Wisconsin, and advocates to try and provide sort of a one-stop shopping place for information about some opportunities within Badger Care Plus and Medicaid, but also Marketplace. So there's phone numbers, there's contact information. The website has a lot of information to help direct you to resources. People will also be getting, you know, if they get their mail, they'll be getting contacted through the mail about the process and renewal. And remember, it's not necessarily a complete reapplication. It's updating their information, but a renewal is, you know, may not be as difficult as a complete reapplication for some people. There's a small group of people that were manually recertified over the course of the public health emergency that will need to file a new application. But that's a smaller subset of the larger, you know, 1.6 million people.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. That's kind of off subject, but what's the latest numbers on what an expansion of Medicaid under the ACA would do for coverage for families and children? And, what would it save money for the state overall? And I'll take my answer up there.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. A long-running political debate here in Wisconsin, Bobby. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer type thing. We should have done it, you know, 10 years ago. The state left money on the table, and it would have made this process a little simpler for some people. It helps to streamline eligibility. Right now, for Badger Care Plus, we have parents sometimes in different coverage than the kids. We create an eligibility, you know, corn maze to try and work through to try and figure out what coverage you have. So not only would the state identify more people for coverage and get them coverage, it would bring in federal dollars. It would streamline the system. It's something that most other states have done. All of our neighboring states all have done it. And a lot of very pretty conservative states have also done it. Wisconsin has dug their heels in. And without providing a good rationale and reason for it. And, you know, it's long overdue. And I think, you know, people should speak up about it because it's just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's resources, it's revenue, and it's a simpler system to use.
Talking to Bobby Peterson, executive director at the public interest group ABC for Health. We're talking about the return of the Badger Care Plus renewal process, what enrollees need to know to maintain their health care coverage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use or have you in the past used Badger Care Plus? What is this exemption over the last few years from having to reapply? What has that meant for you when it comes to keeping that coverage going? What questions do you have about what happens now, what you need to know? Do you have a local provider who offers help with these applications? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Bobby Peterson with ABC for Health, looking at the return of the Badger Care Plus enrollment and re-enrollment process that was put on hold back at the beginning of the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in healthcare or healthcare advocacy, love to know what you are seeing in your part of the state. If you use or have used Badger Care Plus, could you talk about the enrollment process? Could you offer advice maybe for others? Or do you have questions for our guest about what this all means? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Bobby, we heard from Mike in Wauwatosa who couldn't stay on the line. He said he had tried to call into Badger Care and didn't feel like he was getting answers from the Badger Care system. I'm not sure exactly what office he was trying to call into. What might people find if they try to call in? Where would they call in if they wanted to talk to someone who administers Badger Care?
Well, they certainly can call the consortium if they know their information, and they'll be asked some questions about their, you know, the program and if they're a current member. But they also should be, you know, making sure that they get their mail. They can also log into access.gov.wisconsin for, you know, the platform. There's also an app that they can download from the Google or the Apple Store if they want to put it on their phone, which they can check their benefits and coverage. They can get their renewal date online. But there should be opportunities to get through the system. And if he's having trouble, he should go to wiscovered.com, and there's some phone numbers there that he can call for some advocates to get some help from. But you know, I think it's important for people to know too that this is an issue that's, you know, of course it's affecting people on Badger Care Plus, which includes, you know, a lot of folks, but it's also covers some kids with disabilities on Katie Beckett Medicaid. There's programs for people with disabilities called the Medicaid Purchase Plan that this is going to affect them too, and foster care Medicaid. So there's a lot of changes out there. So people that are receiving services through Medicaid need to have their antenna up to make sure that they're paying attention to these changes. There's also people that have aged over the process. So 3 years, you know, people have become eligible for Medicare, which is a different program, not affected by the unwinding, but there are some opportunities for them to make sure that they can transition then into Medicare a little more seamlessly. You know, none of this stuff is easy, but it's all doable. We just have to take our time and work through it, help people through the process, understand, you know, where they are now and where they're going, how old they are, and what coverage they might be eligible for. So it's a painful process to go through for so many people. But I think the goal is to try and keep people covered and hopefully get more people covered. This is one of the outcomes of the public health emergency is that we had one of those lowest rates of uninsurance we've ever had. And that's a good thing. More people with coverage is really better for all of us to maintain healthy people as much as we can, a healthy workforce, people that are going to be able to get the care when they need it.
Thanks for sharing that experience, Mike, at 800-642-1234. I should mention a couple of the websites Bobby has mentioned, wiscovered.com and access.wisconsin.gov. We have those linked at this website, wpr.org/centraltime. We've got links to both of those. One thing I've been reading, Bobby, is, you know, if people are on BadgerCare Plus now and they're hearing this news, they should not rush to reapply right at this moment. They should wait till they get that notification. Do I have that right?
Yep, absolutely. They need to wait. They may not be up for renewal for, you know, it could be into 2024. I mean, it depends a little bit about when they applied and what their normal renewal date would be. But don't jump the gun, you know. I mean, that's why it's important to be vigilant, but not to panic. I mean, we can do a lot of things to help you maintain your coverage. And if your income has gone up over the time period, you may even be eligible for extension for BadgerCare Plus, because there's some rules that if you would lose eligibility because of an increase in income, we want to promote people that can, you know, work their way up the ladder. There's an opportunity to maintain your coverage for BadgerCare Plus too. So it's important to both be patient and diligent, and then look for some help.
Are there bureaucratic hurdles or barriers that, Bobby, you think we might be able to streamline here with the current system?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, it's a major bureaucracy. And as I said before, I think that one of the key things we could do to help streamline it is Medicaid expansion. It's troubling that we separate parents' coverage from their children's coverage sometimes because of income issues. Children have a higher income threshold for BadgerCare Plus, so sometimes parents need to go to the marketplace while their kids are on BadgerCare Plus. And it's more difficult because it's just continuity of coverage. And we know, we learned this way back in the last century, that having parents and kids on the same coverage is better for everyone. There's also, you know, just the process is more difficult. There's opportunities now, I think, in Wisconsin where we're going to have continuous eligibility for kids once they, you know, if their eligibility for BadgerCare Plus is ending. There's new federal rules beginning in 2024 that the state has to provide continuous coverage for the kids for another 12 months, which is good because this is all part of the transition. And sometimes we lose people in the transition from one program to the other. And that's why we're so concerned right now about the public health emergency ending and the unwinding and making certain that people get the coverage that they need and they land in the right spot.
Let's bring on another caller. Ella is with us in Burlington. Ella, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about?
My employer does not offer insurance, and I cannot afford insurance through the marketplace, I believe it's called. And I was wondering, what is the difference between regular BadgerCare and BadgerCare Plus? Because all I really need, really bottom line, is I need help to pay for the insulin that I need.
Mm-hmm. Ella, thanks for the call. We just have a minute or so left. Bobby, do you have thoughts for Ella?
Well, the good news is that the price of insulin is finally coming down, so that expense is low. It's challenging right now without knowing what Ella's income is. She might qualify for some marketplace coverage that could be more affordable. They've increased the subsidies for it, the advanced premium tax credits. So that would be an area really to look into the marketplace to make sure she's not eligible for one of those plans. Doesn't sound like she's going to be eligible for BadgerCare Plus, but we just, without knowing what her income is, her family size, there's just some key information we'd need to know.
Ella, thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last half a minute, Bobby, remind us, people on BadgerCare Plus, what should be on their minds right now?
Well, I think it's, you know, it affects a lot of folks, but it affects, you know, your family members, your friends. Keep an eye in the mail. Reach out to those folks, your loved ones, your neighbors, people that you're in the faith community with. Make sure that they're reading their mail, checking their mail. They know what the dates are. They know the information they need to get back to the consortium for their renewals. This is a real good opportunity to do a little bit of a health benefits tune-up for family members to make sure you're in the right program at the right time. But if we all work together, I think we can make sure that we get through this more smoothly, and fewer people will be losing coverage because it's so important to maintain that coverage.
Bobby, thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome.
Bobby Peterson is Executive Director and a Public Interest Attorney at ABC for Health. He joined us to explain the return of the Badger Care Plus re-enrollment process here in Wisconsin. We've got a couple links at WPR.org/Central Time for information and assistance. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, a doctor answers kids' questions about social media and its impact on children. That's tomorrow morning at 8. We've had the Oscars, sure, and there are your Nobel Prizes out there and the Pulitzers. But now we've got the award announcement we've all been waiting for, the International Mollusk of the Year Award. As shared by the website Metafilter, this is the third annual Mollusk of the Year Award. The program was started a few years back by research outlets around the world to draw attention to our mollusk cousins and the threats they face. This year's winner is the Chilean abalone. According to the award announcement, the Chilean abalone is a large carnivorous limpet with a heavy shell. Its shell size can get up to 15 centimeters, about 6 inches. Even though it looks pretty slow to me, it is a carnivore. Bonus, its blood could be the inspiration for treatments for some forms of cancer in humans. The winning species of the competition gets a complete sequencing of its genome. So take this year to celebrate the Chilean abalone and start lobbying for your favorite mollusk for next year. This is Central Time.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.